This is Eboshi from Cartel Madras, and you're listening to CJSF.
I was on the back of your mind. I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car. You were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do? Take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin. Don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant. Don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double D's. You know what I like? Ice cold.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Bernie, BC.
Hi there, this is Lucy King. Before we start, I want to make a quick request to rate, follow, and subscribe to Making Contact wherever you're listening. Now, on to the show.
Making contact.
Making contact.
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Jessica Partnow, your guest host. And this week, we are honoring the legacy of an incredible person that we lost in November of 2025.
Hi, my name is Alice Wong, and I was elected as a community storytelling fellow at Making Contact.
In 2015, Alice Wong was part of a storytelling fellowship program here at Making Contact, where she got to learn and practice audio storytelling skills and produced a radio story.
I'm excited to create a story about the lives of people with disabilities who use personal assistance and their relationships with their home care providers. People with disabilities are usually the subject of a radio story, but rarely is the person creating the story disabled as well. Representation on both sides matters.
Alice was an activist and an advocate. She was a MacArthur Fellow. She was appointed by President Obama to serve on the National Council on Disability. She founded the Disability Visibility Project and published work in dozens of publications, from the New York Times to Making Contact. The nation called her the first disabled public intellectual. She was only 51 when she died. Her time at Making Contact came relatively early in her rise to public intellectual status. Let's start the episode off by listening to the story Alice produced as a community storytelling fellow here at Making Contact. The first voice you'll hear is Camille. She works as a personal assistant for people with disabilities.
The minute I walked through the door, her name was Gladys. Her face would light up and she'd be so happy. Come on, Camille, this is what we're doing today. We're going to do this, that, and the other. And we would map out our day. I clean the house, get everything done, get her bathed, lay out her clothes for the day. This is what you can wear, this. And I drive her to do whatever it was she needed to do.
Camille Christian is an in-home care provider. Bathing, feeding, dressing, cleaning are among a laundry list of daily living activities involved in long-term care work. It's labor intensive. You're also seeing someone in their most intimate moments. Home care worker Brenda Jackson says her clients are like family.
As a matter of fact, I call her Aunt Mary. So she's part of my family now. So that's why it's important for me to make sure she's happy and she's comfortable and she's in her own home.
Christian says that it's also a matter of dignity.
Everybody needs to feel that they have their own self-respect, that they have their own dignity. And it makes me feel good to know that I'm helping someone have that.
That dignity depends on a balanced, healthy relationship between those receiving care and those giving. So how do we ensure quality care for both, especially as demand for care work is expected to grow? By 2030, the number of senior citizens is projected to double to 72.1 million. As more seniors move into older age brackets, the demand for a younger generation of workers and family members to help with day-to-day life will increase too. A UC San Francisco study estimates at least 2.5 million more workers are needed to fill the long-term care gap. For workers, fair wages, employment protections, job growth, and training are some ways to ensure sustainability in the industry, according to the study's author, Joanne Spetz. Whether you're a paid home care provider or rely on personal assistance to meet your daily needs, or a family member caring for a loved one, the nature of the working relationship banks on mutual respect and dignity. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll explore the dynamic and complex relationship of care receiving and giving. Community storytelling fellow Alice Wong asks, how do people with disabilities who rely on personal assistance negotiate their relationships with the people that assist them? And how does that inform their sense of independence or interdependence with others? In this next story from the San Francisco Bay Area, Wong searches for answers.
Hey, Bob, I'm ready to get up.
Say the how, Ma?
Not too bad.
Okay.
Do you turn off the oxygen?
Okay.
I don't want to get up. But here I am, in bed. Needing to get up and get in my wheelchair. From the minute I wake up, I'm connected to people. Can't get away from it, even if I wanted to. Kenzie Roby is an artist in San Francisco who has multiple people that work for him. Like me, he's in bed when his attendant arrives.
I have no use of my legs, so I'm very dependent on care providers. So when someone comes in the morning, the first thing they need to do, wash their hands. Wash their hands, get gloves, and then check and be sure I'm clean. And I can't urinate unless someone inserts a catheter inside my bladder, and I need to do that several times a day.
When you need help with almost every aspect of your life, it changes the way you relate to others. I got a chance to talk with some of my disabled friends in the Bay Area, exploring their relationships with people who help them with their daily activities. Kenzie says it's different each time he trains a new attendant.
And I've had people that are able to be directed and able to be taught the procedure within 30 minutes or 2 hours. And I've had other people who feel like, well, why are you picking on me? Why do I have to change my gloves? You're wasting material. And I have to tell them that the gloves are disposable. I'm not.
Some people have spouses and family members as their attendants, whether they're paid or unpaid. Ingrid Tischer lives in Berkeley with her husband. Here's their typical morning.
When we get up, he's the person in the household who sort of gets the day started by making the coffee, starting the breakfast. And I sleep at night using a BiPAP machine.
A BiPAP machine helps a person breathe.
So I get up and sort of take care of that. This is funny. But I would say in the time that I've been married, it's probably been the first time in my adult life when I could wear pretty much anything I want or do something with my hair without it being a big deal. And he can help me button things, pull things on, zip things, and then like tie my hair back if I want. And he's really good natured about it, the way, you know, it makes it nice.
Hey!
Hey!
How are you?
I love your hair. Another Berkeley resident, Alana Terrio, has been living independently for 34 years. She employs 6 attendants and extra backup workers for shifts throughout the week. They go where she goes, including the home and out in the community.
I hate driving on the freeway, but they're all very good sports and drive me where I need to go. And then bring me home, set me up with a snack, help me open my mail, do whatever paperwork at the house, make dinner. And they leave at 6 p.m. And at that point, I have a little downtime, which is nice.
Having privacy can be hard when you need assistance often.
I don't have enough alone time now. I have the care hours that I need. And that's fabulous, but at the same time, I don't have the alone time that I miss. I miss that now.
Anyone who uses personal assistance is part director, choreographer, and actor. Patty Byrne is the director of Sins and Ballad, a performing arts group in Berkeley. She compares her work to how she gets her needs met.
Like, seriously, people are like, where do you get such skills? And I'm like, well, you know what it takes me to get dressed every day? Like, that is a production. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I can manage, like, a show, you know? Because, like, I produce an event every day when I'm dressed and, you know, fed
That's
and comfortable.
The choreography, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Being disabled and using personal assistance isn't a solo act. It's an ensemble production where relationships are the key to a successful show. Mom, can you make me some coffee now?
Okay.
One pivotal scene in my daily drama is how I gotta have my coffee every afternoon when working from home. Since I can't make it myself and I'm picky about my coffee, I communicate clearly and supervise my mom, who's one of my attendants. My addiction to coffee is at stake, and it must be satisfied.
Yes, Mom. You're welcome.
For Alana, it's all about teamwork.
I try to foster relationships between the workers. It's nice because usually I have 2 to 3 days of training, and then maybe 1 or 2 attendants involved in that training. So right off the bat, they meet each other, and I'll encourage them to say, I don't know, maybe we should call so-and-so, find out how we deal with this problem. Or I encourage them to call each other when they need a sub, so it's not just all on email.
There are a lot of ways disabled people express their thanks to their attendants. Showing gratitude can go a long way.
Once a year, I host an attendant appreciation dinner where we go out. And as I build relationships with them, they care about me, and I care about them.
Care is involved in the work of personal assistants, but it's impossible to ignore the power dynamics. Rachel Stewart, who lives and works in Alameda, describes the give-and-take nature of the relationship.
I think I'm still learning, and I think that like you said, it's a very fine line, but it's kind of like also letting people know when like the line has been crossed. It's like, okay, like I really need you to be on time because I'm going to pee my pants unless you're here on time. Mm-hmm. You know, like just being really frank and upfront mm-hmm. with people is really important, and being honest, but also like showing your appreciation. And it's a hard one to navigate.
Yeah. Navigating these boundaries can be tricky, especially if your attendant is also your family member. Ingrid describes the understanding she has with her husband, Ken.
I don't ever have to be concerned, for example, that one of us is going to use our argument to sort of get back at the other one in the course of assisting, usually me, with something. And I think it's important for the health of the relationship because at some point, Ken is going to need help from me more than he does now. And I think if we have a foundation of knowing what each other's limits are and what we will not transgress, that's what the health of the relationship is built on.
Appreciation, trust, communication, and a shared sense of responsibility can keep relationships strong between attendants and disabled people. Keeping balance between your actions and your politics is another vital aspect. Patty recalls a time when she supported her attendant.
You know, one of my attendants, unfortunately, she recently broke her wrist. And rather than being like, okay, you're disposable, I'm just going to hire somebody else, I hired an assistant for her mm-hmm. to help with the pieces of the routine that she couldn't do anymore. Because that makes sense, right? And so, you know, it's just, you know, how do we meet our needs collectively, you know? And it's really cool because these nuances of movement that she didn't realize I was contributing to the routine, now that she's doing one-handed, mm-hmm. she's like seeing things, oh, yeah, actually, right. Like Patty's supporting her own balance.
So for Patty, this is an example of disability justice in action. Communities can create collective access, and no one is disposable. Jessica Lehman is the executive director of Senior Disability action in San Francisco. She tells me when she first connected disability justice with domestic workers' rights.
What happens at my home is, you know, a little piece of that big picture that I'm talking about and that I have really committed my life to. And it just felt like the best example of the personal is political and of what an opportunity I have to learn and to live my values, to tie together what I care about, you know, to bring the values that I put out into the world to really feel that in my own body and in my own home, and to be able to work on that with other people.
Hey, Ma. I'm ready to go to bed now.
Okay, 好了,去睡觉吧. Yeah. 这么晚了。
Can you turn on my hospital bed?
床啊,哈。
Can you turn on the oxygen, please? Well, it's time for me to go to bed. As my mom turns on my oxygen machine and my air mattress, I'll leave you with these final thoughts. Disabled people and their attendants are both vulnerable and resilient. Our relationships and well-being are linked. How we treat each other is a reflection of the kind of world we want to live in. Our labor has value. We are stronger together. For the Beijing Contact Storytelling Fellowship, I'm Alice Wong.
That segment was hosted by Laura Flynn and produced by Alice Wong. You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Jessica Partnow. This week, we are celebrating the life and legacy of Alice Wong. I personally only really got to know Alice's work a few years ago. My husband became disabled in 2020, and overnight, we found ourselves living in a completely different world. You know, we could just get trapped on a block where there wasn't a curb cut. Suddenly, we couldn't go over to most of our friends' houses because they all had stairs. When he talks, people will be sure that they just can't understand him because his voice doesn't sound like what they're expecting. People will talk to me about him like he's just not there. It can be really lonely. So when I found the company of Alice's writing, her openness and vulnerability, her fiery frustration, it was a big relief just to understand that we weren't alone and that we were very, very much not alone. Many, many people were living with these kind of experiences and had been for a long time and had been working as activists and advocates in this space for many years before it entered my life so personally. And Alice wrote about this as part of her storytelling fellowship here at Making Contact. She wrote a piece called Diversifying Radio with Disabled Voices, talking about some of the ableism that is very, very present in this field. You can find the full essay at our website, focmedia.org. It is a wonderful piece. I really encourage you to read it. And I want to read an excerpt of it here, called The Story of My Voice. I love this section of the piece because it's coming from the perspective of a person with vocal difference. I wish that we could be listening to Alice's voice read this, but I will try to do her beautiful writing justice with my voice. Story of My Voice, an excerpt of an essay by Alice Wong. In 2015, I started becoming interested in radio as a result of a community partnership I formed with StoryCorps, focused on recording the stories of people with disabilities. I had concerns about people who would be excluded from participation due to the oddest nature of oral histories. As I figured out ways to provide options and access for people who communicate visually or non-verbally, I thought more about the medium of radio and whether disabled lives, voices, and bodies are considered part of the public media landscape. I have a neuromuscular disease called spinal muscular atrophy. This is a progressive condition where all the muscles in the body slowly weaken over time. My body's changed over the 40-something years of my life. I transitioned from walking to using a walker to a manual wheelchair, electric wheelchair, customized wheelchair. Throughout this process, I learned to adjust. Over time, I required more assistance, coming in the form of personal assistance, technology, or services. Even with a healthy set of lungs, my lung function has steadily declined since I turned 18 because of my weakening diaphragm muscles that are responsible for the act of breathing. In fact, I had a medical crisis when I went into respiratory failure due to sleep apnea. My diaphragm needed support, and that's when I started using non-invasive ventilation. I became Darth Vader. A BiPAP machine provides ventilatory support. That is, the BiPAP pushes breaths of air into a person's lungs at a set rate and volume. These breaths enter the body through a tube and mask. It's a lifesaver and something I'll use for the rest of my life. I'm now in a phase of my life where I use the BiPAP during the day. This started about 2 years ago and is now the norm. Using the BiPAP in the day meant a lot of changes and adjustment. I have a machine by my bed and one that I can carry on the back of my wheelchair. The one on my wheelchair has a battery, something that is invaluable and facilitates my ability to be in the community. As I attend meetings and gatherings, I noticed a difference in the way people related to me. I have to repeat myself because people can't understand me. If a breath is coming in right in the middle of speech, I have to pause, leaving these unnatural and awkward speech patterns. When I talk too long when using my mask, I tend to salivate a lot and need to pause to swallow. This can be especially frustrating if I'm in public spaces, trying to order something at a cafe or asking a question to someone at Trader Joe's. I find myself having to suppress the feeling of being self-conscious and embarrassed at my vocal difference. A big part of my identity, ego, and self-image is centered on my voice and writing. I had to confront my discomfort and accept my new sound and body that has become even more cyborg-like as time goes on. I had to regain my sense of pride, and that only happens through practice. To paraphrase Laura Hershey's poem, "You Get Proud by Practicing," March 1991. Even with my politicized disability identity, I have to remind myself that the problem isn't located in my body, but society and my own internalized ableism. I also have to remember I'm not alone and I'm part of a large community of disabled people with vocal differences. Radio, like any cultural institution, enforces normalcy. This normalcy is centered on the ability to hear and speak well. With the exception of community radio that features shows by disabled people, e.g. Pushing Limits on KPFA, Disability Matters on Voice America, and podcasts, you don't hear a lot of people that sound different due to disability on public radio, except for Diane Rehm. It's time for people in radio to think critically about messages they are transmitting by excluding certain voices and lived experiences. Symphonic disabled voices. On radio, I want to hear people who lisp, stutter, gurgle, stammer, wheeze, repeat themselves, pause when needing to breathe, make noises when they talk, salivate and drool, communicate, enunciate, and pronounce differently. Use different speech patterns and rhythms. Use ventilators or other assistive technology. Use sign language interpreters or other people that facilitate speech. Use computer-generated speech. I want to disrupt what's thought of as the default public radio voice. I want to challenge listeners as they ride the subway, jog on their treadmills, drive on their commute. Even if the sounds and words we create might require greater concentration and attention. That was an excerpt from Alice Wong's essay, Diversifying Radio with Disabled Voices. You can read the full piece at focmedia.org. In that essay, Alice mentions a poem by Laura Hershey called "You Get Proud by Practicing," written in 1991. And we're so lucky that Alice recorded herself reading it. So here it is. Alice Wong reading "You Get Proud by Practicing," a poem by Laura Hershey.
If you are not proud for who you are, for what you say, for how you look, if every time you stop to to think of yourself. You do not see yourself glowing with golden lights. Do not, therefore, give up on yourself. You did get proud. You did not need a better body, a pure spirit, or a PhD to be proud. You do not need a lot of money, a handsome boyfriend, or a nice car. You do not need to be able to walk, nor see or hear, nor use big, complicated words, nor do any of the things that you just can't do to be proud. A cheeseburger cannot make you proud, or a doctor. You only need more practice. You get proud by practicing. There are many ways to get proud. You can try riding a horse, or skiing on a lake, or playing guitar. And do well or not so well, they'd be glad you tried either way. You can show something you've made to someone you respect. They'd be happy with it no matter what they say. You say what you think, so you know other people do not think the same way. And you can keep saying it, even if they tell you you're crazy. You can add your voice all night to the voices of 150 others in a circle around a jailhouse. Where your brothers and sisters are being held. For body buses with no lift. Or you could be one of those ones inside the jailhouse. Knowing of the circle outside. Did you speak your love to a friend without fear? Do you find someone who will listen to you? Without judging you or doubting you? Or being afraid of you? To let you hear yourself, perhaps for the first time. These are all ways of getting proud. None of them are easy, but all of them are possible. Do you do all of these things? Or just one of them again and again. You get proud by practicing. The power makes you proud. The power comes in many fine forms, supple and rich, as butterfly wings. It is music when you practice, opening your mouth and liking what you hear, because it is the sound of your own true voice. It is sunlight when you practice. See strength and beauty in everyone, including yourself. It is dance when you practice knowing that what you do and the way you do it is the right way for you. It can't be called wrong. All these hold more power than the weapons or money or lies. All these practices bring power, and power makes you proud. You get proud by practicing. Remember, you weren't the one who made you ashamed, but you are the one who can make you proud. Just practice. Practice until you get proud. Then once you are proud, keep practicing so you won't forget. You get proud by practicing.
Thank you to Alice Wong for a lifetime of getting proud by practicing. Rest in power. That's it for Making Contact this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Partnow.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.